the objects of the game is quite different. The object of the game in football is for the quarterback, otherwise known as the field general, to be on target with his aerial assault.
Can U.S. team sports be separated from U.S. militarism? We hear from comedian George Carlin on football and speak with Nation Magazine sports editor Dave Zirin.
This is coming from people who work in the CIA, who work in the Pentagon, who insist on endless war, and who believe that they're a government unto themselves, more powerful than the president.
The extradition trial of WikiLeaks founder and former editor Julian Assange continues on the outskirts of London.
I think that Mr. Boot would have been happy if Trump had waterboarded Putin at the summit and made him confess.
Eminent Russian studies scholar and Russiagate dissident Stephen F. Cohen has died.
It's not like you're saying the law doesn't matter.
The law matters, but if the law is the only thing you're relying on, everything is going to be too little too late.
Both major U.S. parties seem to be planning to subvert democracy to save it. From Pacifica Radio, this is COVID, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from the Pacifica Radio Network and its affiliate stations across the U.S. I'm your host, Ann Garrison. Can U.S. team sports be separated from U.S. militarism? The U.S. claims the inherent right to rule the world, and the Pentagon divides it into five geographic commands, plus cyber, special operations, transportation, strategic, and now space commands. The U.S. also lavishly celebrates its military at sporting events, most of all, basketball and football. Will the current sports activism around racial injustice ever extend to the global neocolonial racial injustice that European elites continue to impose on Latin America, Africa, and East and South Asia? Nation Magazine sports editor Dave Zirin is here to help us think about that. Dave, thanks for joining COVID, Race, and Democracy.
Oh, thanks for having me.
We're going to start by playing a bit of George Carlin on baseball and football. I'm sure you know this routine very well, but our listeners might not.
Baseball is a 19th century pastoral game. Football is a 20th century technological struggle. Baseball is played on a diamond in a park, the baseball park. Football is played on a gridiron in a stadium, sometimes called Soldier Field or War Memorial Stadium. Baseball begins in the spring, the season of new life. Football begins in the fall when everything is dying. In football, you wear a helmet.
In baseball, you wear a cap.
Football is concerned with downs. What down is it?
Baseball is concerned with ups. Who's up? Are you up? I'm not up. He's up.
In football, the specialist comes in to kick.
In baseball, the specialist comes in to relieve someone.
In football, you receive a penalty.
In baseball, you make an error. Whoops!
Football has hitting, clipping, spearing, blocking, piling on, late hitting, unnecessary roughness, and personal fouls.
Baseball has the sacrifice.
Football is played in any kind of weather. Rain, sleet, snow, hail, mud. Can't read the numbers on the field, can't read the yard markers, can't read the players' numbers. The struggle will continue.
In baseball, if it rains, we don't come out to play. I can't come out to play. It's raining out.
Baseball has a seventh inning stretch. Football has the 2-minute warning.
Baseball has no time limit. We don't know when it's going to end. We might have extra innings.
Football is rigidly timed and it will end even if we have to go to sudden death.
In baseball, during the game in the stands, there's kind of a picnic feeling. Emotions may run high or low, but there's not that much unpleasantness. In football, in the stands during the game, you can be sure that at least 27 times you were perfectly capable of taking the life of a fellow human being. Preferably a stranger. And finally, the objectives of the two games are totally different. In football, the object is for the quarterback, otherwise known as the field general, to be on target with his aerial assault, riddling the defense by hitting his receivers with deadly accuracy, in spite of the blitz, even if he has to use the shotgun. With short bullet passes and long bombs, he marches his troops into enemy territory, balancing this aerial assault with a sustained ground attack which punches holes in the forward wall of the enemy's defensive line.
Okay, Dave Zirin, do you think Carlin nailed the essence of America's most popular sport?
I really do think that George Carlin did, because there's so much militarism that's baked into the cake of football in this country. I mean, football really begins at the start of the U.S. imperial project, and it was something that was popularized by Teddy Roosevelt. I mean, so you have this one person, Teddy Roosevelt, who, of course, was very famous before he was ever president, who was the number one cheerleader of both empire and football. And that's not just a coincidence, because he thought one would prepare young people to enact the other. Now, that being said, I don't think football has to be so militaristic. It could certainly be less militaristic than it currently is, but it's such a feature of football. It's not a bug.
Last January, when the Pentagon assassinated Iran's hero, General Qasem Soleimani, Colin Kaepernick made headlines simply by tweeting, quote, "America has always sanctioned and besieged black and brown bodies, both at home and abroad. American militarism is the weapon wielded by American imperialism to enforce its policing and plundering of the non-white world." There's nothing new about American terrorist attacks against black and brown people for the expansion of American imperialism. That's what he tweeted, most eloquently, but he still seems to be putting in all the hours it takes in the gym and on the field to play football, still hoping for that call back into the NFL. So he doesn't seem to believe that the sport is inseparable from its militarist, imperialist trappings. Do you think more players will be able to develop and express a similar global and historical understanding of racial injustice and survive in the game?
Well, we've seen it in the past. There were certainly players who were against the war in Vietnam, most famously Dave Megacy, who quit the NFL in his prime because he believed that the war in Vietnam and the National Football League were really one and the same, and that professional football and college football was gearing people up for war. And then also during the quote-unquote war on terror, specifically the war in Iraq, you had players like Scott Fujita, Adelius Thomas, and other football players speak out against war. So, I mean, it's certainly something that's real. You know, these players, we have to remember, are part of the world. They don't, you know, exist on a separate planet called Planet Athlete, and then they come down and entertain us and then go on their spaceships and return. These are people who are part of the world. And when there are movements against war, they're affected by those movements. What I think we have to remember is that it always starts with the movement. It always starts with what's happening off the field. And we shouldn't expect athletes to develop a kind of political consciousness independent of movements and ideas developing away from the field of play.
Do you think the rules of the game can remain in place without all the military packaging? I'm talking mostly about basketball and football, most of all football, since these two sports are most given to combat and territorial metaphors and also seem most saturated with military display and recruiting.
Yeah, I mean, I think first and foremost, in our incredibly warlike society, every instrument of pop culture, not just sports, can be geared towards war efforts. And we've seen that. And baseball has a rich history of being part of war efforts in this country and imperial efforts. I mean, from Latin America to East Asia to World War II and the amount of players who enlisted and did all sorts of things for the USO and the like. I mean, war and baseball, I mean, baseball is not somehow pure and football is impure. Like, that's just not, the 20th century refutes that pretty hard. But I do think, though, it is possible, certainly, that in a different kind of society, that you could have these sports and not have them dominated by war, and play could happen for the sake of play, for the sake of joy, for the sake of exercise, and you wouldn't have the kind of foghorn of militarism that exists way too often in professional and often collegiate sports.
I was getting optimistic about NBA activism till 9/11, when inside the NBA hit bottom with all the 9/11 military jingoism, but without mentioning that the U.S.-led, quote, global war on terrorism, unquote, has displaced at least 37 million people in 8 countries since 2001, or that it's left at least 800,000 people dead at a cost of $6.4 trillion to U.S. taxpayers. This is according to the report, quote, Creating Refugees, Displacement Caused by the United States Post-9/11 Wars, unquote, released by Brown University scholars on September 8. Inside the NBA is one of my favorite TV shows, but I had to turn it off on 9/11. I couldn't take it. Did you see it?
Well, I honestly don't remember. I mean, it's been almost 20 years, and I do remember consuming a tremendous amount of sports media after 9/11. And so I assume inside the NBA is just very similar to what I saw elsewhere, which was like the volume just cranked up of people who were there to turn tragedy into war, or were there to turn what happened at 9/11 into a massive mobilization to bomb and occupy other countries. I mean, it was a terrible tragedy and a terrible misuse of sports at that time. And, you know, I think it's so important that we need to have an anti-war movement in this country, you know, that's consistent, because otherwise, when these conflagrations take place, we'll find ourselves with, you know, some of the things that we look to for escape, like sports, all of a sudden mobilized against us, and not only us, but the people of the world who bear the brunt of U.S. militarism.
Eloquent. Is there anything else you'd like to say about this?
Just that, like, I think we should fight for a better sports world. You know, we shouldn't assume that the sports world is somehow intrinsically militaristic, and we should reject it the way a vegetarian might reject a leg of lamb. I think we should get away from that mentality and think instead of rejecting sports, how we can reclaim it, because there's a lot of good in sports. You know, we've got to remember that, like, sports has given us a lot of things that we do want to reject. But it's also given us Muhammad Ali, it's given us Billie Jean King, it's given us Colin Kaepernick, and it's given us some moments of absolute poetry. And so, just like I would say this about art as well, but we shouldn't reject sports, we should try to reclaim it.
Oh yeah, well, one thing I like about it is that you have to play by the rules to win.
Very different from politics.
Yes, yes. Okay, David Zirin, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
And that was Nation Magazine sports editor David Zirin. His work can be found on his website, edgeofsports.com, and on the Nation website. With former NBA player Eaton Thomas, he co-hosts The Collision, Sports and Politics, which airs on Pacifica's WBAI New York City and WPFW Washington, D.C. A text version of this conversation will be published on this week's Black Agenda Report, blackagendareport.com. This is Pacifica Radio's COVID Race and Democracy. I'm your host, Ann Garrison. Stephen F. Cohen, an eminent Russian studies scholar and author of many books on Russia, has died at age 81. Cohen was an outspoken critic of Russiagate, and his last book was, quote, War with Russia? From Putin and Ukraine to Trump and Russiagate. This is his exchange with neoconservative Max Boot on CNN, recorded shortly after President Trump's 2018 Helsinki summit with Russian President Vladimir Putin.
The striking thing to me is that although he's willing to threaten North Korea, he's willing to threaten Iran, he never threatens Russia. And that's why a lot of intelligence officials think that there is something highly suspect in the relationship between Putin and Trump.
I have no idea what Mr. Boot is talking about. He wants Trump to threaten Russia. Why would we threaten Russia? You've got two nuclear
because
superpowers.
Because they're attacking us. Russia is attacking us, Professor Cohen. Russia is attacking us right now, according to Trump's own director of national intelligence.
Russia, I've been studying Russia for 45 years. I've lived in Russia and I've lived here.
And you've been consistently an apologist for Russia in those 45 years.
Russia hasn't... Excuse me, what did you say to me?
I said you've been consistently an apologist for Russia in those last 45 years.
All right, I don't do defamation of people. I do serious analysis of serious national security problems. When people like you call people like me, and not only me, but people more eminent than me, apologists for Russia, because we don't agree with your analysis, you are criminalizing diplomacy and detente, and you are the threat to American national security. End of story. Why do you have to defame somebody you don't agree with it? They used to do that in the old Soviet Union. We don't do that here. Well, we used to, but we need to stop it.
So just finally, Stephen, you're saying Russia was not attacking the United States?
I know what you're talking about. That during the 2016 election, Russia attacked the United States. Yes, I don't think they attacked the United States.
Okay, and yet you just denied being an apologist for Russia. You're apologizing for Russia as we speak.
Well, you haven't let me finish. You don't know what I'm going to say. The meddling began right after the Russian Revolution when Woodrow Wilson sent American troops to fight in the Russian Civil War against the
Communists.
The meddling began on the Soviet and Russian, let me finish, on the meddling side when the Communists formed the Communist International, 1919. Ever since then, Moscow's meddled in our politics, we have meddled in theirs. This is low-level stuff, what went on. It is not an attack. It is not 9/11. It is not Pearl Harbor. It is not Russian paratroopers descending on Washington. This kind of hyperbole, an attack on America, suggests we need to attack Russia. So you've got Mr. Boot saying that Trump should threaten Russia? With what? Does he want to attack?
Try sanctions.
You know what I think? I think that Mr. Boot would have been happy if Trump had waterboarded Putin at the summit and made him confess. Trump carried out an act of diplomacy fully consistent with the history of American presidents. Россия, священная наша держава, Россия, любимая наша страна, могучая воля, великая слава, твое достоинство.
The extradition hearings in the case of founder and former editor-in-chief of WikiLeaks, Julian Assange, continued on the outskirts of London. Here's journalist Glenn Greenwald.
Let's remember that the criminal investigation into Julian Assange began by the Obama administration because in 2010, WikiLeaks published a slew of documents, none of which harmed anybody, not even the government claims that. That was very embarrassing to the Obama administration. It revealed all kinds of abuses and lies that they were telling about these endless wars that the Pentagon and the CIA are determined to fight. They were embarrassing to Hillary Clinton. And so they initiated a grand jury investigation to try and prosecute him for reporting to the public. He worked with the New York Times, The Guardian, to publish very embarrassing information about the endless war machine, about the neocons who were working in the Obama administration. To understand what's happening here, we can look at a very similar case, the prosecution by the Obama administration as well of Edward Snowden, for the same reason that he exposed the lies that James Clapper told. He exposed how there's this massive spying system that the NSA and the CIA control that they can use against American citizens. And this is coming from people who work in the CIA, who work in the Pentagon, who insist on endless war, and who believe that they're a government unto themselves, more powerful than the president. I posted this weekend a speech from Dwight Eisenhower warning that this military-industrial complex, what we now call the deep state, is becoming more powerful than the president.
In the councils of government, we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
Chuck Schumer warned right before President Trump took office that President Trump challenging the CIA was foolish because they have many ways to get back at anybody who impedes them.
You take on the intelligence community, they have six ways from Sunday at getting back at you.
They're punishing Julian Assange and trying to punish Edward Snowden for informing the public about things they have the right to know about the Obama administration. They're basically saying to President Trump, you don't run the country, even though you were elected. We do. And they're daring him to use his pardon power to put an end to these very abusive prosecutions. One which resulted in 8 years of punishment for Julian Assange for telling the truth. The other one which resulted in 7 years of exile for Edward Snowden of being in Russia simply for informing the public and embarrassing political officials who are very powerful. He could have pardoned him and Edward Snowden. And there's widespread support across the political spectrum on both the right and the left for doing both. It would be politically advantageous for the president. The only people who would be angry would be Susan Rice, John Brennan, Jim Comey, and James Clapper, because they're the ones who both of them exposed.
This is Pacifica Radio's COVID, Race, and Democracy. We'll be back after a short break. Stay with us.
America is a lie. I know how much this hurts your feelings. And I'm not saying this to cause you strife, it's just that I've heard this bit all my life. The propaganda you spit, the rose-colored myths you declare. While I'm so caught up in survival, I have to seek it in prayer. I guess it goes back to your gangster beginnings, your genocidal inclinations, your belief in unhappy endings, your well-practiced ability to create the other, your dark willingness to separate the child from its mother, your unequal fascination with how to make things die, your unparalleled hierarchical reasons why, your unreasonable insistence that we all are free, but when you use that word, you ain't talking about me. And when you champion rights, if I try to use them, it's wrong. When I resist your insanity, you try to make me dead and or gone. But I know your history all too well, and that is why I reach no other conclusion except America is a lie. And no, I didn't say the president, cause this is bigger than him. Your ugliness goes through cycles. This ain't about no one man. I'm talking about the whole enchilada and the republic for which it stands. Ain't much emotion in my voice because it is what it is. You have gone this way choice after choice, and you a lie. But don't worry, cause I ain't in awe. I know a thief appreciates possession being 9/10 of the law, and you a lie. But don't worry, cause I ain't in fear. Your reign is temporary. I see it leaving here to be replaced by a power that's equal and fair, that loves life and humanity everywhere, that respects women and children as the divine creatures they are, that vibrates with the poet's line that everybody's a star. Not an either-or world, but a place of both and. A new world where we all understand our divine connection and provide respect, love, and protection, where we all sing in one voice, the elders, children, the youth. America is a lie, but we are the truth.
We just heard a poem by Dr. Obiedike Kamau of Pacifica's KPFT Houston. This is Pacifica Radio's COVID, Race, and Democracy. I'm Ann Garrison. Now, as the presidential campaign hits its final stretch, members of both the Republican and Democratic Party expect chaos and develop strategies to achieve their preferred outcomes. A bipartisan, quote, transition integrity project, unquote, has also come together to game various electoral outcomes and legislative, legal, and military responses. Here's Samantha Bee of Comedy Central's Full Frontal.
Shall we play a game?
In the 1983 movie War Games, a super powerful speaking spell simulates a global thermonuclear war. But recently, there was a real and more terrifying war game, the 2020 election. The organizer, Georgetown law professor, and pleasant-faced nightmare smith, Rosa Brooks, she co-founded the Bipartisan Transition Integrity Project, which recently assembled a large group of experts to game out election scenarios.
The goal of these exercises was to shock people a little bit into realizing that there is no guarantee that everything is going to be fine.
It turns out nothing was fine.
So tell me a little bit about the simulation that you held.
We had about 70 people participate in our exercises, and these were serious people. You know, they were Republicans, they were Democrats, they were former White House chiefs of staff. We looked at several different scenarios, and in pretty much every scenario we ran, we ended up with street-level violence, constitutional impasse, and complete political and legal chaos.
Violence, chaos, and no clear winner for each realistic scenario. A close race on election night and Trump blocks mail-in ballots.
Chaos.
Close Biden win, but Trump claims fraud and rejects results.
Chaos.
Big Biden win, but Trump still won't concede.
Chaos.
Trump loses popular vote, but wins electoral college amidst foreign meddling.
Chaos. You'd think the rules governing a contested election are simple, but they're a mess and open to debate and totally useless when you're playing against a cheating sociopath.
It's not like you're saying the law doesn't matter.
The law matters, but if the law is the only thing you're relying on, everything is going to be too little too late.
Now, here's Alex Cristoforu of the Duran.
This is textbook color revolution, and I think this think tank is telegraphing exactly what they're going to do when they get the results they are anticipating. They know Trump will win the Electoral College, but they believe a popular vote in favor of Biden, and that will be the springboard for the color revolution.
Investigative journalist Greg Palast spoke to Dennis Bernstein on KPFA's Flashpoints.
And so they're going to claim, for example, that a post office in Tallahassee has 100,000 ballots from North Korea or Venezuela. It's all fake, and those will be burnt. There will be riots. He's talking about riots in the street. They want this. They want this, riots. They want the burnings of the post office. They want the closure of the polling centers is too dangerous, and maybe even on the day. You know, if you're going to have seven-hour lines, all someone has to do is create mayhem and the lines scatter. So what's going to happen? How does the 12th Amendment, how does it come into play? Simply, the Florida legislature in 2000 certified George Bush electors to go to the Electoral College before the count was even over. This time, expect them to say there's too much mayhem, hundreds of thousands of votes in Florida can't be counted, the post offices have been burned down, the counting centers, the county offices are besieged, there's gunfire in the streets. We can't certify the vote in Florida, even though everyone knows that Biden won it. So there's no electors from Florida. Detroit's in flames. Milwaukee's in flames. Again, the Republican-controlled legislature of those two states say, we can't certify the vote. And remember, the vote in most states has to be certified by November 30. It's going to be pretty close to impossible to count all the mail-in votes by November 30, especially if there's going to be continuous challenges, mayhem, riots, and other problems. Remember, New York couldn't count its ballots in 7 weeks. California never counts its ballots in less than 30 days, just so you know. It's likely that we're going to have three states, if there's mayhem, especially if they expect that Biden is, in fact, the winner in Michigan and Wisconsin. They'll just stop the count on November 30, say we can't certify. So three states don't send electors to the Electoral College, which meets on December 14th. They get one single vote. There's not several ballots. No one is going to get 270 votes, in which case it goes constitutionally to the House of Representatives, one state, one vote. So each delegation chooses, and there's 26 Republican delegations. That's the presidency. That way, it's actually constitutional that he will be reelected by the 12th. At least that's his projection. And I think it's a real possibility. And in other words, we will have a president elected by rioting, flames, threats, intimidation, and that will all work to reelect him by the 12th Amendment.
Lastly, retired Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, Chief of Staff to former Secretary of State Colin Powell, in conversation with Paul Jay on Jay's YouTube show, TheAnalysis.News.
Might there be a split in the military? If Trump really wants to push this to the edge, even if somebody like a Milley and others that are, you know, in these terms, more rational, might there be a split in the military about how to respond to what would be a kind of a Trump anti-constitutional coup?
Yes, there could be. Very worrisome possibility, and not one that we're not looking at. But I would say that of late, what has happened, and one of the positive aspects of what has happened, is that my concern would have been more with the ranks than it would have been with the upper officer corps. And I think what polls are showing right now is that even the ranks, many of whom, a large percentage of whom voted for Trump in 2016, are falling off. They're no longer Trump supporters. So my concern in the past would have been that we'd have a split in the military that would more or less follow rank structure, with some of the higher rank, as you've just indicated, maybe some of the evangelicals falling in with the lower ranks. But I don't think that's a problem anymore. I'm hoping it's not anyway. I don't think you're going to have. Now, we do have, as you know, we do have some neo-Nazis in the military. Indeed, we've had reports. Some come into the military for a 3-year stint and they get training in the military and go back to their neo-Nazi group. Ali Soufan has written about that and about the danger of this sort of domestic terrorism, if you will. But I think basically the armed forces are going to stay what we used to say in parlance, stay in barracks, that they will not come out to do anything against the American people or, for that matter, to do anything that the president might order them to do that would lead to something like that.
The U.S. continues to plot an overthrow of the president of Nicaragua, Daniel Ortega. This time, the job seems to have been advertised on LinkedIn. We'll hear from journalist Ben Norton of The Gray Zone, speaking to Leonardo Flores on Code Pink Radio, which airs on WPFW Washington, D.C. and WBAI New York City.
I've been living actually here in Nicaragua. And of course, the U.S. government has seen Nicaragua as this bastion that has an anti-imperialist foreign policy. Nicaragua strongly supports Venezuela and Cuba. Nicaragua is part of the ALBA Alliance. Nicaragua has a very activist foreign policy in supporting national liberation movements and anti-colonial movements. It's very close to Russia. So the U.S. has targeted Nicaragua for decades to overthrow the government and install a more compliant puppet regime that will privatize the economy, impose neoliberal policies. 2 years ago in 2018, there was a coup attempt. The main groups leading it were right-wing neoliberal groups that were backed by the U.S. government, by the National Endowment for Democracy, which is an arm of the CIA created by the Ronald Reagan administration in the 1980s. So we see terror attacks, absolutely horrifying. I mean, a kind of civil war scenario where the right-wing opposition is trying to overthrow the government. They were unsuccessful because ultimately the opposition is very small in Nicaragua. And there is a very hardcore base of around two-thirds of the country, 50 to 60% of the country that support the Sandinistas. And the opposition only has a support around 10, maybe 15%, that's being generous. They couldn't succeed in overthrowing the government. So, of course, as with Venezuela, after the 2014 and 2017 coup attempts, the Guarimbas, the U.S. government turns toward its other form of warfare, economic warfare, sanctions.
In Cuba, Venezuela, and Nicaragua, we see the perils of poisonous ideologies left unchecked and the dangers of domination and suppression. Under this administration, we will no longer appease dictators and despots near our shores. The troika of tyranny in this hemisphere, Cuba, Venezuela, and Nicaragua, has finally met its match.
The NECA Act was already written by members of the right-wing Florida neoconservatives. You know, these are the right-wing exiles from Cuba, Venezuela, Nicaragua, other countries who went to Miami. And they were already lobbying there even before the coup attempt. And they had this legislation that was prepared. But the coup attempt and the media propaganda allowed them to push through this legislation, which put very brutal sanctions on Nicaragua. It's a de facto blockade that prevents Nicaragua from accessing international financial institutions. And then since the NECA Act was passed, and I should mention that unfortunately, it was passed in the Congress without any opposition. The Trump administration has continued to impose more and more sanctions. And this brings us to the lead up to the election in 2021, next year, about a year from now. And the Trump administration, it's very clear, and even if Biden somehow manages to win, it's clear that either administration, they're already planning on another coup attempt in the upcoming year.
So the latest news in this attempted regime change by the Trump administration in Nicaragua has to do with this RAIN plan, Responsive Assistance in Nicaragua. You recently wrote an article about it. Can you explain to us what this plan is and what it entails?
RAIN, this is just the latest regime change scheme. And I should mention that this is really under the aegis of the U.S. Agency for International Development, USAID. This is a group that claims to be humanitarian. It claims to be the humanitarian arm of the U.S. government, but it's another CIA cutout. like I mentioned, the National Endowment for Democracy, the NED. These groups are very similar. They have origins at the end of the Cold War, and the U.S. government realized that they could basically kind of outsource the CIA color revolution apparatus that it developed during the Cold War. And a lot of the work that the CIA did then, they could just do it openly in the name of democracy promotion. This group, Democracy International, posted a job application on LinkedIn calling for someone who can be a senior level technical expert in democracy, human rights, and governance. What happened is apparently, it seems pretty likely that someone in Nicaragua who supports the Sandinistas applied for this job and then was sent this 14-page document outlining the strategy and published it. In 14 pages, they used the word transition 102 times. That's a nice word for regime change. And they spell out three different scenarios for regime change, which would be hard regime change, soft regime change, and prolonged regime change. So hard would be a military coup, an overthrow of the government. They say that one of the top, quote, mission goals is, and I'm quoting exactly from the document, quote, transition to a rules-based market economy, and that's based on, quote, protection of private property rights. Okay, so they want a neoliberal government that will overthrow the socialist economic policies, that will privatize the economy, that will privatize education and healthcare. And then they also say, what is their other goal? One of their other top so-called mission goals is, quote, rebuild institutions and, quote, reestablish and dismantle parallel institutions. And they specifically target the military and the police. So what they mean by that is they want to, quote, reestablish the military and the police. They want to create new military and new police forces that purge all of the nationalists and the Sandinista loyalists who support the Sandinista revolution. Basically, this is a model. This is modeled after the de-Ba'athification program in Iraq. After the U.S. government invaded Iraq and overthrew the government, they understood that there would be elements of the government that would be sympathetic and supportive of the old government who want to restore the Ba'athist government. So they had a policy of de-Ba'athification, removing anyone who had been involved in the previous government, anyone who had nationalist sensibilities, and then create a new technocratic regime of puppets who will be subservient to the U.S.
And for Nicaragua, I mean, we have to like mention that under President Ortega, you talked about it a bit, but Nicaragua has cut poverty in half. They've nearly eliminated illiteracy. They've seen a huge increase in women holding public offices. They've addressed the gender pay gap. And the country has become much more economically equal now than it was prior to the Sandinistas coming back into power.
Nicaragua is still part of the ALBA Alliance created by Hugo Chavez in Venezuela. And we can't underestimate how much the U.S. government, even above other priorities, one of its top priorities is destroying these other economic alliances that were developed.
That was Ben Norton speaking to Leonardo Flores on Code Pink Radio, which airs on WPFW and WBAI. Stay with us. We'll be back after a short break.
Yo no le digo tío Don Samuel, porque hermano de mi patria usted no es. Y cuando en la mesa del pueblo falta el pan, recuerdo que en la historia claro está que usted lleva gorilas al poder. Usted es inteligente, Don Samuel, hasta una bomba atómica inventó. Pero es muy debilucho en el amor, y como a usted la muerte le da placer, sobre el hombre indefenso la lanzó. Le gusta la guerra, Don Samuel, porque le sobran balas y soldados no le faltan. Además son valientes, Don Samuel, a fuerza de lavados de heroína y marihuana. Don Samuel, sus muchachos regresan a casa, mutilados, medio locos, con aroma a mierda. Usted lo arregla todo, don Samuel, nadita de nada se le escapa. De desempleados le da un carnet y una medalla y la libertad, sobre todo la libertad de matar carajitos negros en Atlanta. Usted super de todo, don Samuel, y además de sabotear aviones, ya produjo su bomba de neutrones, que solo mata gente, según dice. Usted es un descarado, un inmoral, aunque sus cancerberos lo defiendan, de la primera letra hasta la Z. Se le llena de baba la jeta al mentirle al pueblo en nombre del tío Sam.
With presidential election angst and intrigue in the background, tenants are waging struggles against abusive landlords and courts trying to restart the eviction mill in the middle of the coronavirus pandemic. WBAI's Working Class Heroes show has this story.
With over 16 million people out of work, researchers have estimated that up to 40 million people are now at risk of evictions in the upcoming months without intervention. While movements across the country have pushed for the cancellation of rent, in large part funded by proposed increases in taxes for the rich, tenants have mainly gotten a hodgepodge of rolling eviction moratoriums issued by federal and local governments, and even by individual court systems that refuse to hear new eviction cases. The CDC issued an eviction moratorium extension until the end of the year.
Even with clear moratoriums prohibiting landlords from evicting tenants on the basis of non-payment, many landlords have attempted to push out their tenants by other means. Landlords have hired people to harass tenants or have themselves harassed tenants and even physically locked tenants out of their apartment in order to get them to leave on their own. But tenants have been pushing back.
Here is what Marisol Morales from Community Action for Safe Apartments in the Bronx had to say.
Esta pandemia solo está ayudando a los ricos a ser más poderosos y a hundir al pobre.
This pandemic is only helping the rich to amass more and more power and to sink the poor.
Le pedimos una cancelación de renta.
He put him in that seat and he has to use it to cancel the rent.
At that rally, WCH also spoke to Marni Halasa, who was there in support of small business owners who are also facing widespread fear of evictions and closures of their commercial spaces and who are seeking relief.
And my understanding is that small business owners have less rights than most tenants.
Correct. They have, the business owners, the rent-stabilized tenants at least have the right to renew. Small businesses want really one thing, the right to renew. And if you get the right to renew, then you'll never get kicked out of your space. So that's really the solution for all the businesses closing. Also, with the Small Business Job Survival Act legislation that has a majority in support in council, that you can actually, with your landlord, negotiate fair terms for a longer lease, like for a 10-year lease. So we would rather have that than this other inferior stuff that the council is pushing, which is the rent stabilization bill. And the rent stabilization bill will have a board with real estate development and economic development corporation people that really are in bed with the city and don't have the best interests of the small business owner. So that's what I have to say. I hope it's not too complicated, but really, like, small businesses are really dying and nobody's really coming to our aid, and it's just atrocious.
We also spoke to South Bronx tenant movement leaders who are fighting against a rent hike that doubles their rent and also the illegal lockout of one of their neighbors and fellow tenant union members, Maricela.
Porque nunca se presentó, nunca dijo nada, solamente...
He never introduced himself or came here. He only sent a couple of us a paper giving us 90 days notice to start paying double the rent. $2,500 overnight or be evicted. The last owner never gave us a lease renewal, and so the new landlord claims that we are now illegally living here and they could throw us out. Our 90 days are up at the end of September, and that's what we are fighting, that they give us a lease, a reasonable rent amount, and for Mrs. Maricela to be able to come back because he evicted her with harassment and almost by physical force. He knows that she doesn't speak Spanish. She's indigenous. We think it's unfair. He evicted her in May in the midst of the pandemic, even though there was a moratorium. He didn't care what the law said. It's what he wanted. And that's what we are asking for, a lease, a fair rent, apartment repairs, and for Maricela to come back to her home.
That was Working Class Heroes Radio, a New York City-based investigative narrative radio show documenting the lives of working-class New Yorkinos. It airs on Pacifica's WBAI. Prisoners on lockdown in Harris County Jail, Houston, Texas, say they are very concerned that protective measures have not been implemented since a number of them were diagnosed with COVID-19. Pacifica producer Akua Holt spoke to Capital Baker in Harris County Jail, where he's been locked up for 2 years, just awaiting trial.
While we're on lockdown, no cleanup comes in here. They wait till we're off of lockdown, and then they'll come in here and they'll pressure wash the shower, they'll pressure wash the sinks and the garbage. Other than that, there's no cleanup, and that's only like once a month when they come in if we're off quarantine. City bringing people in.
You're telling us in a 30-day period, or lockdowns are sometimes 2 weeks. I'm not certain how long the lockdowns happen in the Harris County Jail. But you're telling us during that time frame, you have a number of people in the same dorm or room.
Right.
There is no sanitation until after the lockdown.
Right now, they moved us from 7H2. We're here in 4F4 right now, and it's 28 people in here. And yeah, they don't clean up for 30 days. They don't come spray the wall down or the tables. It's rust on the tables. It's really foul in here. We try to keep it clean as much as we can, but it's only so much we can do without the proper chemicals to keep us clean.
At one time, Jay-Z and a gentleman by the name of Van Jones had a initiative where they were sending cleaning supplies to various prisons and institutions throughout the country. Do you think an initiative such as the one they had would help in your situation?
I mean, it's possible. I think it would help. However, the jail is really strict on delivering the products to the needy cells. That's the problem. They get, some of them are just lazy and they won't bring it.
Are you saying that inmates would be allowed to clean if you had the proper supplies? They wouldn't be worried about a safety or security issue?
Right. Well, a lot of the reason why they claim they haven't given us all the chemicals that needed is because they the threat of something happening to one of us. Mm-hmm. We're all adults. Everyone does his part as much as he can in this position. So, yeah, I think that there will be some change if they allowed us to have more chemicals to clean up. Well, now they started changing 2 times a week, so that's good. But sometimes they go 3 and 4 weeks without changing the clothes, and our towels be nasty, and it gets real bad.
Brother, I it's just mind-blowing listening to... Capital Baker is on with us, talking about the conditions in the jail. But it's really unfortunate that human beings are experiencing this kind of treatment and condition during COVID. Again, before we close, tell us what we can do to help.
Contact the sheriff of Harris County and let them know that We need chemicals. If y'all can donate the chemicals to the jailhouse for us to get fresh chemicals, please do. Donate masks, because even though we go outside, they don't provide the masks as frequent as they do, and the little masks that they have, they dissolve quick. Mm-hmm. So if you can provide masks, if you can do anything to help change the condition of the jail, please do.
Lockdown lasts a period of time, but after that, are you allowed to have visitors?
No, we're not allowed to have any visitors to the jailhouse.
Have 1 minute left.
Canceled the visitation.
Tell us how we can write you. Would you like for us to write you and keep in touch? I don't know if you can give us your information. Do you have an email?
My name is Frank Baker. I also go by Capital Baker. And 0264-2261, dorm 4F4 at 701 North San Jacinto, Houston, Texas 77002. Please contact. Uh-huh. I'll write you back.
That was Capital Baker from Harris County Jail in Houston, Texas, speaking with KPFT Houston's Akua Holt. Baker's organization, Walls of Hope, offers counsel to male prisoners who are having difficulty coping with being locked down 24/7. From Dr. Mark Elaine Derry and Dr. Eric D. Griggs of Pacifica Affiliate 102.3 FM WHIVLP in New Orleans, here's news on the coronavirus.
With the pandemic continuing, we are desperately finding ways to combat COVID-19 and to decrease mortality rate as well as decrease infections. Now, there is a new theory involving bradykinin that may explain many aspects of COVID-19 and why certain parts of the body experiences more symptoms than other parts. Also, once COVID-19 is in the body, it hijacks our body's system and tricks it into upregulating ACE2 receptors in places where they're normally expressed at low or medium levels, including the lungs. An example for this is, let's say a burglar comes into your house, steals your stuff, but then opens up all the windows to allow more burglars to come in as well. And so this may explain why you see people experience respiratory, cardiac, and GI problems.
Yeah, the system that controls all this is the renin-angiotensin system. The renin-angiotensin system controls the circulatory system and includes a chemical called bradykinin. Bradykinin is a product that lowers our blood pressure by opening our blood vessels. And it also increases our vascular permeability, meaning it makes our blood vessels more leaky than usual. Normally, we have an enzyme called angiotensin converting enzyme that breaks down bradykinin. COVID-19 can downregulate angiotensin converting enzyme, or ACE, and cause an increase in bradykinin.
So let me recap right now and step away from the technical stuff. COVID-19 gets through a cell through ACE2 receptors, yep, and then it creates more ACE2 receptors for more virus to come in. And then what it does, it down-regulates the enzyme that is needed to clear out another chemical called bradykinin. So by downregulating it, it means that it virtually eliminates it. So you have more ACE2 receptors and you have more bradykinin,
which makes the vessels more leaky, which means there's more fluid leaking out of blood vessels and things get really, really wet.
That's exactly right. So as bradykinin is building up in the body, it causes fluids and immune cells to leak into the lungs.
Thus the cough, thus the pneumonia.
Right, which causes inflammation and some of the respiratory distress that people are experiencing. Also, COVID-19 increases the production of hyaluronic acid when combined with fluids. It creates like a jelly-like substance, which makes it harder for people to breathe either with or without the ventilator. This can also explain why ventilators weren't shown to work as well. It's also been shown that COVID-19 can cause cardiac problems, which we've talked about here, possibly due to there being too much bradykinin, leading to low blood pressure as well as arrhythmias, which is abnormal heart rhythms. Now, people may experience neurological symptoms as well because bradykinin, guess what, can cause a breakdown of the blood-brain barrier, which acts as a filter to keep certain things in and out of the brain. So this whole bradykinin theory is fascinating.
It's absolutely fascinating. Bradykinin gets in to make things leakier and wetter. But as a consequence of making things leakier, it can decrease the amount of volume in our cardiovascular system, which means your blood pressure gets lowered and it causes your heart, because it doesn't have the normal amount of fluid in it, to beat in irregular rhythms. Now, the blood blood-brain barrier thing, it's the exact same thing. Things get leaky. There's a purpose of the blood-brain barrier is to allow only certain things to get into our central nervous system, which, I mean, as it connects, Doc, we're talking about all these neuropathies, the brain fog, the whole nine. We've really stumbled onto something with this whole bradykinin thing.
Thanks for that to Drs. Marc-Alain Derry and Eric D. Griggs of the Noise Filter Show, which airs on the Pacifica affiliate, WHIV New Orleans. That concludes today's edition of COVID Race and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and its radio affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. Today's show was produced by Polina Vasiliev and myself, Fan Garrison. The show's executive producers are Akua Holt, Steve Seltzer, and Polina Vasiliev. Verna Avery Brown is our executive consultant. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, covidtaskforce.pacifica.org. Thanks for listening.